Do you know... he began, then stopped. He looked down at his clenched hands then, not at me. A blue stone winked on one knuckle, bright as a teardrop. Do you know, he said again softly, addressing his hands, what it is to love someone and never, never be able to give them peace or joy or happiness? He looked up then, eyes filled with pain. To know that you cannot give them happiness, not through any fault of yours or theirs, but only because you were not born the right person for them. I sat quiet, seeing not his, but another handsome face, dark, not fair. Not feeling the warm breath of the tropical night, but the icy hand of a Boston winter. Seeing the pulse of light like heart's blood spilling across the cold snow of hospital linens. Only because you were not born the right person for them. I know, I whispered, hands clenched in my lap. I had told Frank, leave me. But he couldn't. No more than I could love him rightly, having found my match elsewhere. Oh, Frank, I said silently, forgive me. I suppose I'm asking whether you believe in fate, Lord John went on. The ghost of a smile wavered on his face. You, of all people, would seem best suited to say. You'd think so, wouldn't you? I said bleakly. But I don't know any more than you. He shook his head, then reached out and picked up the miniature. I have been more fortunate than most, I suppose, he said quietly. There was the one thing he would take from me. His expression softened as he looked down into the face of the boy in the palm of his hand. And he has given me something most precious in return. Without thinking, my hand spread out across my belly. Jamie had given me that same precious gift, and at the same great cost to himself. The sound of footsteps came down the hall, muffled by the carpet. There was a sharp rap at the door, and a militiaman stuck his head into the office. "Is the lady recovered yet?" he asked. "Captain Jacobs has finished his questions, and Monsieur Alexandre's carriage has returned." I got hastily to my feet. "Yes, I'm fine." I turned to the governor, not knowing what to say to him. "I thank you for... that is..." He bowed formally to me, coming around the desk to see me out. "I regret extremely that you should have been subjected to such a shocking experience, ma'am," he said, with no trace of anything but diplomatic regret in his voice. He had resumed his official manner, smooth and polished as his parquet floors. I followed the militiaman, but at the door I turned impulsively. "When we met that night aboard the Porpoise, I'm glad you didn't know who I was. I liked you. Then." He stood for a second, polite, remote. Then the mask dropped away. "I liked you too," he said quietly. "Then." I felt as though I were riding next to a stranger. The light was beginning to grey toward dawn, and even in the dimness of the coach I could see Jamie sitting opposite me, his face drawn with weariness. He had taken off the ridiculous wig as soon as we drove away from Government House, discarding the facade of the polished Frenchman to let the dishevelled Scot beneath show through. His unbound hair lay in waves over his shoulders, dark in that pre-dawn light that robs everything of colour. "Do you think he did it?" I asked at last, only for something to say. His eyes were closed. At this, they opened, and he shrugged slightly.
"I don't know," he said.
He sounded exhausted.
"I've asked myself that 1,000 times tonight, and been asked it even more."
He rubbed his knuckles hard over his forehead.
"I can't imagine a man I know to do such a thing. And yet... well... you ken he'll do anything when he's drink taken. And he's killed before, drunk. You'll mind the customs man at the brothel."
I nodded, and he leaned forward, elbows on his knees, sinking his head into his hands.
"This is different, though," he said. "I kinda think. But maybe so. It came what he said about women on the ship. And if this Mrs. Alcott was to have toyed with him..."
"She did," I said. "I saw her." He nodded without looking up.
"So did any number of other people. But if she led him to think she meant more than she maybe did, and then perhaps she put him off, maybe laughed at him. And him, foo as a puggy we drink, and knives to hand on every wall of the place."
He sighed and sat up.
"God knows," he said bleakly. "I don't."
He ran a hand backward through his hair, smoothing it.
"There's something else about it. I had to tell them that I scarcely knew Willoughby, that we'd met him on the packet boat from Martinique and thought it kindly to introduce him about, but didn't I ken a thing of where he came from or the sort of fella he truly was."
"Did they believe it?" He glanced at me wryly.
"So far. But the packet boat comes in again in 6 days, at which point they'll question the captain and discover that he's never laid eyes on Monsieur Etienne Alexandre and his wife, let alone a wee yellow mothering fiend."
"That might be a trifle awkward," I observed, thinking of Fergus and the militiaman. "We're already rather unpopular on Mr. Willoughby's account."
"Nothing to what we'll be if 6 days pass and they haven't found him," he assured me. 6 days is also maybe as long as it will take for gossip to spread from Blue Mountain House to Kingston about the MacIvors' visitors. For you ken the servants there all know who we are."
"Damn!" He smiled briefly at that, and my heart turned over to see it.
"You've a nice way with words, Sassenach. Aye, well, all it means is that we must find Ian within 6 days. I shall go to Rose Hall at once, but I think I must just have a wee rest before setting out."
He yawned widely behind his hand and shook his head, blinking. We didn't speak again until after we had arrived at Blue Mountain House and made our way on tiptoe through the slumbering house to our room. I changed in the dressing room, dropping the heavy stays on the floor with relief, and taking out the pins to let my hair fall free. Wearing only a silk chemise, I came into the bedroom to see Jamie standing by the French door in his shirt, looking out over the lagoon. He turned when he heard me, and beckoned, putting a finger to his lips.
"Come see," he whispered.
There was a small herd of manatees in the lagoon, big grey bodies gliding under the dark crystal water, rising gleaming like smooth wet rocks. Birds were beginning to call in the trees near the house. Besides this, the only sound was the frequent whoosh of the manatees' breath as they rose for air, and now and then an eerie sound like a hollow, distant wail as they called to each other. We watched them in silence, side by side. The lagoon began to turn green as the first rays of sun touched its surface. In that state of extreme fatigue, where every sense is preternaturally heightened, I was as aware of Jamie as though I were touching him. John Gray's revelations had relieved me of most of my fears and doubts, and yet there remained the fact that Jamie hadn't told me about his son. Of course he had reasons, and good ones, for his secrecy. But didn't he think he could trust me to keep his secret? It occurred to me suddenly that perhaps he had kept quiet because of the boy's mother. Perhaps he had loved her, in spite of Grey's impressions. She was dead. Could it matter if he had? The answer was that it did. I had thought Jamie dead for 20 years, and it had made no difference at all in what I felt for him. What if he had loved this young English girl in such a way? I swallowed a small lump in my throat, trying to find the courage to ask him. His face was abstracted, a small frown creasing his forehead, despite the dawning beauty of the lagoon. "What are you thinking?" I asked at last, unable to ask for reassurance, fearing to ask for the truth.
"It's only that I had a thought," he answered,
still staring out at the manatees.
"About Willoughby, eh?"
The events of the night seemed far away and unimportant. Yet murder had been done.
What was that?
Well, I couldn't think at first that Willoughby could do such a thing. How could any man?
He paused, drawing a finger through the light mist of condensation that formed on the window panes as the sun rose.
And yet...
He turned to face me.
Perhaps I can see.
His face was troubled. He was alone.
Very much alone.
A stranger in a strange land, I said quietly, remembering the poems painted in the open secrecy of bold black ink, sent flying toward a long-lost home, committed to the sea on wings of white paper.
Aye, that's it.
He stopped to think, rubbing a hand slowly through his hair, gleaming copper in the new daylight.
And when a man is alone that way, well, it's maybe no decent to say it, but making love to a woman is maybe the only thing will make him forget it for a time.
He looked down, turning his hands over, stroking the length of his scarred middle finger with the index finger of his left hand.
That's what made me wed Lyra, he said quietly. Not Jenny's nagging. Not pity for her or the wee lasses. Not even a pair of aching balls.
His mouth turned up briefly at one corner, then relaxed.
Only needing to forget I was alone, he finished softly.
He turned restlessly back to the window.
So I'm thinking that if the Chinee came to her, wanting that, needing that, and she wouldn't have taken him.
He shrugged, staring out across the cool green of the lagoon.
Aye, maybe he could have done it, he said.
I stood beside him. Out in the centre of the lagoon, a single manatee drifted lazily to the surface, turning on her back to hold the infant on her chest toward the sunlight. He was silent for several minutes, and I was as well, not knowing how to take the conversation back to what I had seen and heard at Government House. I felt rather than saw him swallow, and he turned from the window to face me. There were lines of tiredness in his face, but his expression was filled with a sort of determination, the sort of look he wore facing battle.
"Claire," he said.
And at once I stiffened. He called me by my name only when he was most serious.
"Claire, I must tell you something."
"What?" I'd been trying to think how to ask, but suddenly I didn't want to hear. I took half a step back, away from him. But he grabbed my arm. He had something hidden in his fist. He took my unresisting hand and put the object into it. Without looking, I knew what it was. I could feel the carving of the delicate oval frame and the slight roughness of the painted surface.
"Claire."
I could see the slight tremor at the side of his throat as he swallowed.
"Claire, I must tell you. I have a son."
I didn't say anything, but opened my hand. There it was, the same face I had seen in Gray's office, a childish, cocky version of the man before me.
"I should have told you before."
He was searching my face for some clue to my feelings, but for once my giveaway countenance must have been perfectly blank.
"I would have, only..."
He took a deep breath for strength to go on.
"I haven't ever told anyone about him," he said. "Not even Jenny."
That startled me enough to speak.
"Jenny doesn't know?"
He shook his head and turned away to watch the manatees. Alarmed by our voices, they had retreated a short distance, but then had settled down again, feeding on the waterweed at the edge of the lagoon.
"It was in England. He's... I couldn't say he was mine. He's a bastard, aye."
It might have been the rising sun that flushed his cheeks. He bit his lip and went on.
"I haven't seen him since he was a wee lad. I never will see him again, except it might be in a wee painting like this."
He took the small picture from me, cradling it in the palm of his hand like a baby's head. He blinked, head bent over it.
I was afraid to tell you, he said, low-voiced, for fear you would think that perhaps I'd gone about spawning a dozen bastards. For fear you'd think that I wouldn't care for Brianna so much if you kent I had another child. But I do care, Claire. A great deal more than I can tell you.
He lifted his head and looked directly at me.
Will you forgive me?
Did you?
The words almost choked me, but I had to say them.
Did you love her?
An extraordinary expression of sadness crossed his face, but he didn't look away.
No, he said softly. She wanted me. I should have found a way, should have stopped her, but I couldn't. She wished me to lie with her, and I did, and she died of it.
He did look down then, long lashes hiding his eyes.
I'm guilty of her death before God. Perhaps the more guilty, because I did not love her.
I didn't say anything but put up a hand to touch his cheek. He pressed his own hand over it, hard, and closed his eyes. There was a gecko on the wall beside us, nearly the same colour as the yellow plaster behind it, beginning to glow in the gathering daylight.
"What's he like?" I asked softly. "Your son."
He smiled slightly without opening his eyes.
"He's spoilt and stubborn," he said softly, "ill-mannered, loud. We are wicked temper."
He swallowed.
"And braw and bonny and canty and strong," he said,
so softly I could barely hear him.
"And yours," I said.
His hand tightened on mine, holding it against the soft stubble of his cheek.
"And mine," he said.
He took a deep breath, and I could see the glitter of tears under his closed lids.
"You should have trusted me," I said at last.
He nodded slowly, then opened his eyes, still holding my hand.
"Perhaps I should," he said quietly. "And yet I kept thinking, how should I tell you everything about Geneva and Willie and John? Will you know about John?"
He frowned slightly, then relaxed as I nodded.
"He told me about everything."
His brows rose, but he went on.
"Especially after you found out about Lyra. How could I tell you and expect you to know the difference?"
"What difference?"
"Geneva, Willie's mother. She wanted my body," he said softly, watching the gecko's pulsing sides. "Lyra needed my name and the work of my hands to keep her and her bairns."
He turned his head then, dark blue eyes fixed on mine.
"John? Well..."
He lifted his shoulders and let them drop.
"I couldn't have given what he wanted, and he is friend enough not to ask it." "But how shall I tell you all these things?" he said, the line of his mouth twisting. "And then say to you, it's only you I've ever loved. How should you believe me?"
The question hung in the air between us, shimmering like the reflection from the water below.
"If you say it," I said, "I'll believe you."
"You will?"
He sounded faintly astonished.
"Why?"
"Because you're an honest man, Jamie Fraser," I said, smiling so that I wouldn't cry. "And may the Lord have mercy on you for it."
"Only you,"
he said, so softly I could barely hear him.
"To worship you with my body, give you all the service of my hands, to give you my name and all my heart and soul with it. Only you. Because you will not let me lie, and yet you love me."
I did touch him then. "Jamie," I said softly, and laid my hand on his arm. "You aren't alone any more." He turned then and took me by the arms, searching my face. "I swore to you," I said, "when we married. I didn't mean it then, but I swore, and now I mean it." I turned his hand over in both mine, feeling the thin, smooth skin at the base of his wrist, where the pulse beat under my fingers, where the blade of his dirk had cut his flesh once, and spilled his blood to mingle with mine forever. I pressed my own wrist against his, pulse to pulse, heartbeat to heartbeat. "Blood of my blood," I whispered.
"Bone of my bone."
His whisper was deep and husky. He knelt quite suddenly before me and put his folded hands in mine, the gesture a Highlander makes when swearing loyalty to his chieftain.
"I give you my spirit," he said,
head bent over our hands. "Till our life shall be done," I said softly. "But it isn't done yet, Jamie, is it?" Then he rose and took the shift from me, and I lay back on the narrow bed, naked, pulled him down to me through the soft yellow light, and took him home and home and home again. And we were neither one of us alone. Chapter 60. The Scent of Gemstones. Rose Hall was 10 miles out of Kingston, up a steep winding road of reddish dust that led into Blue Mountains. The road was overgrown, so narrow that we must ride in single file most of the way. I followed Jamie through the dark, sweet-scented caverns of cedar boughs, under trees nearly 100 feet high. Huge ferns grew in the shade below, the fiddleheads nearly the size of real violin necks. Everything was quiet, save for the calling of birds in the shrubbery, and even that fell silent as we passed. Jamie's horse stopped dead once, and backed up, snorting. We waited as a tiny green snake wriggled across the path and into the undergrowth. I looked after it, but could see no farther than 10 feet from the edge of the road. Everything beyond was cool green shadow. I half hoped that Mr. Willoughby had come this way. No one would ever find him in a place like this. The Chinaman had not been found, in spite of an intensive search of the town by the island militia. The special detachment of marines from the barracks on Antigua was expected to arrive tomorrow. In the meantime, every house in Kingston was shut up like a bank vault, the owners armed to the teeth. The mood of the town was thoroughly dangerous. Like the naval officers, it was the militia colonel's opinion that if the Chinaman were found, he would be lucky to survive long enough to be hanged.
"Be torn to pieces, I expect,"
Colonel Jacobs had said as he escorted us from the residence on the night of the murder.
"Have his balls ripped off and thrust down his stinking throat, I dare say,"
he added, with obvious grim satisfaction at the thought.
"I dare say,"
Jamie had murmured in French, assisting me into the carriage. I knew that the question of Mr. Willoughby was still troubling him. He had been quiet and thoughtful on the ride through the mountains, and yet there was nothing we could do. If the little Chinese was innocent, we couldn't save him. If he was guilty, we couldn't give him up. The best we might hope for was that he wouldn't be found. In the meantime, we had 5 days to find young Ian. If he were indeed at Rose Hall, all might be well. If he were not... A fence and small gate marked the division of the plantation from the surrounding forest. Inside, the ground had been cleared and planted in sugar cane and coffee. Some distance from the house, on a separate rise, a large, plain, mud-daubed building stood, roofed with palm thatch. Dark-skinned people were going in and out, and the faint cloying scent of burnt sugar hung over the place. Below the refinery, or so I assumed the building to be, stood a large sugar press. A primitive-looking affair, this consisted of a pair of huge timbers crossed in the shape of an X, set on an enormous spindle surmounting the box-like body of the press. 2 or 3 men were clambering over the press, but it wasn't working at present. The oxen who drove it were hobbled some distance away, grazing. "How did they ever get the sugar down from here?" I asked curiously, thinking of the narrow trail we had come up. "On mules?" I brushed cedar needles off the shoulders of my coat, making myself presentable.
"No," Jamie answered absently. "They send it down the river on barges. The river's just over there, down the wee pass you can see beyond the house."
He pointed with his chin, reining up with one hand and using the other to beat the dust of travel from the skirts of his coat.
"Ready, Sassenach.
as I'll ever be. Rose Hall was a two-storied house, long and graciously proportioned, with a roof laid in expensive slates rather than in the sheets of tin that covered most of the planters' residences. A long veranda ran all along one side of the house, with long windows and French doors opening onto it. A great yellow rosebush grew by the front door, climbing on a trellis and spilling over the edge of the roof. The scent of its perfume was so heady that it made breathing difficult, or perhaps it was only excitement that made my breath come short and stick in my throat. I glanced around as we waited for the door to be answered, trying to catch a glimpse of any white-skinned figure near the sugar refinery above. "Yes, sir." A middle-aged slave woman opened the door, looking out curiously at us. She was wide-bodied, dressed in a white cotton smock, with a red turban wrapped round her head, and her skin was the deep, rich gold in the heart of the flowers on the trellis.
"Mr. and Mrs. Malcolm to call upon Mrs. Abernathy, if you please," Jamie said politely.
The woman looked rather taken aback, as though callers were not a common occurrence, but after a moment's indecision she nodded and stepped back, swinging the door wide.
"You'll be waiting in the salon, please, sir," she said,
in a soft lilt that made it salon.
"I be asking the mistress, will she see you?"
It was a large room, long and graciously proportioned, lit by huge casement windows all down one side. At the far end of the room was the fireplace, an enormous structure with a stone overmantel and a hearth of polished slates that occupied nearly the whole wall. You could have roasted an ox in it without the slightest difficulty, and the presence of a large spit suggested that the owner of the house did so on occasion. The slave had shown us to a wicker sofa and invited us to be seated. I sat, looking around, but Jamie strolled restlessly about the room, peering through the windows that gave a view of the cane fields below the house. It was an odd room, comfortably furnished with wicker and rattan furniture, well equipped with fat, soft cushions, but ornamented with small, uncommon curios. On one window ledge sat a row of silver handbells, graduated from small to large. Several squat figures of stone and terracotta sat together on the table by my elbow, some sort of primitive fetishes or idols. All of them were in the shape of women, hugely pregnant, or with enormous rounded breasts and exaggerated hips, and all with a vivid and mildly disturbing sexuality about them. It wasn't a prudish age by any means, but I wouldn't have expected to find such objects in a drawing room in any age. Somewhat more orthodox were the Jacobite relics: a silver snuffbox, a glass flagon, a decorated fan, a large serving platter, even the large woven rug on the floor, all decorated with a square white rose of the Stuarts. That wasn't so odd. A great many Jacobites who had fled Scotland after Culloden had come to the West Indies to seek the repair of their fortunes. I found the sight encouraging. A householder with Jacobite sympathies might be welcoming to a fellow Scot, and willing to oblige in the matter of Ian. "If he's here," a small voice in my head warned. Steps sounded in the inner part of the house, and there was a flutter at the door by the hearth, and Jamie made a small grunting sound as though someone had hit him, and I looked up to see the mistress of the house step into the room. I rose to my feet, and the small silver cup I had picked up fell to the floor with a clank.
"Kept your girlish figure, I see, Claire."
Her head was tilted to one side, green eyes gleaming with amusement. I was too paralysed with surprise to respond aloud, but the thought drifted through my stunned mind that I couldn't say the same for her. Gillis Duncan had always had a voluptuous abundance of creamy bosom and a generous swell of rounded hip. While still creamy-skinned, she was considerably more abundant and generous in every dimension visible. She wore a loose muslin gown, under which the soft, thick flesh wobbled and swayed as she moved. The delicate bones of her face had long since been submerged in swelling plumpness, but the brilliant green eyes were the same, filled with malice and humour. I took a deep breath and got my voice back. "I trust you won't take this the wrong way," I said, sinking slowly back onto the wicker sofa. "But why aren't you dead?" She laughed, the silver in her voice as clear as a young girl's.
"Think I should have been, do you?
Well, you're no the first, and I dare say you'll not be the last to think so, either." Eyes creased to bright green triangles by amusement, she sank into her own chair, nodded casually to Jamie, and clapped her hand sharply to summon a servant. "Shall we have a dish of tea?" she asked me. "Do, and I'll read the leaves in your cup for you, after. I've a reputation as a reader, after all. A fine teller of the future, to be sure. And why not?" She laughed again, plump cheeks pinkening with mirth. If she'd been as shocked by my appearance as I was at hers, she disguised it masterfully. "Tea," she said, to the black maidservant who appeared in response to the summons. "The special kind in the blue tin, aye? And the bitty cakes with the nuts in, too." "You'll take a bite?" she asked, turning back to me. "'Tis something of an occasion, after all. I did wonder," she said, tilting her head to one side, like a gull judging the chances of snatching a fish, "whether our paths might cross again after that day at Cranesmuir." My heart was beginning to slow, the shock overcome in a great wave of curiosity. I could feel the questions bubbling up by the dozens, and picked one off the top at random. "Did you know me?" I asked, "when you met me in Cranesmuir?" She shook her head, the strands of cream-white hair coming loose from their pins and sliding down her neck. She poked haphazardly at her knot, still surveying me with interest. "Not at the first, no. Though sure, and I thought there was a great strangeness about you. Not that I was the only one to think that. You didn't come through the stones prepared, did you? Not on purpose, I mean." I bit back the words, "not that time," and said instead, "No, it was an accident. You came on purpose, though, from 1967. She nodded, studying me intently. The thickened flesh between her brows was creased, and the crease deepened slightly as she looked at me. "Aye, to help Prince Chalach." Her mouth twisted to one side as though she tasted something bad, and quite suddenly she turned her head and spat. The globule of saliva hit the polished wooden floor with an audible plop.
"Angeltia salach itelchach," she said. "Filthy Italian coward."
Her eyes darkened and shone with no pleasant light.
"Had I known, I should have made my way to Rome and killed him while there was time. His brother Henry might have been no better, though. A bollockless, snivelling priest, that one. Not that it made a difference. After Culloden, any Stuart would be as useless as another."
She sighed and shifted her bulk, the rattan of the chair creaking beneath her. She waved a hand impatiently, dismissing the Stuarts.
"Still, that's done with for now. You came by accident, walked through the stones near the date of a fire feast, did you? That's how it usually happens."
"Yes," I said, startled. "I came through on Beltane." "But what do you mean, usually happens? Have you met a great many others, like us?" I ended hesitantly. She shook her head rather absently. "Not many." She seemed to be pondering something, though perhaps it was only the absence of her refreshments. She picked up the silver bell and rang it violently.
"Damn that Clotilda!"
"Like us," she said, returning to the question at hand.
"No, I haven't. Only one besides you, that I can. You could have knocked me over with a feather when I saw the wee scar on your arm and kent you for one like myself."
She touched the great swell of her own upper arm, where the small vaccination scar lay hidden beneath the puff of white muslin. She tilted her head in that bird-like way again, surveying me with one bright green eye.
"No, when I said that's how it usually happens, I meant judging from the stories. Folk who disappear in fairy rings and the stone circles, I mean. They usually walk through near Beltane or Samhain,
A few near the sun feasts, Midsummer's Day or the winter solstice.
That's what the list was, I said suddenly, reminded of the grey notebook I had left with Roger Wakefield. You had a list of dates and initials, nearly 200 of them. I didn't know what they were, but I saw that the dates were mostly in late April or early May or near the end of October.
Aye, that's right. She nodded, eyes still fixed on me in speculation.
So you found my wee book? Is that how you knew to come and look for me on Craig na Dan? It was you, no, that shouted my name just before I stepped through the stones.
Gillian, I said, and saw her pupils widen at the name that had once been hers, though her face stayed smooth. Gillian Edgars. Yes, it was me. I didn't know if you saw me in the dark.
I could see in memory the night-black circle of stones, and in the centre the blazing bonfire and the figure of a slim girl standing by it, pale hair flying in the heat of the fire.
I didn't see you, she said. It was only later when I heard you call out at the witch trial and thought I'd heard your voice before. And then, when I saw the mark on your arm.
She shrugged massively, the muslin tight across her shoulders as she settled back.
Who was with you that night? She asked curiously. There were two I saw, a bonny dark lad and a girl.
She closed her eyes, concentrating, then opened them again to stare at me.
Later on, I thought I kent her, but I couldn't put a name to her, though I could swear I'd seen the face.
Who was she?
Mistress Duncan. Or is it Mistress Abernathy now?
Jamie interrupted, stepping forward and bowing to her formally. The first shock of her appearance was fading, but he was still pale, his cheekbones prominent under the stretched skin of his face. She glanced at him, then looked again, as though noticing him for the first time.
"Well, and if it's no the wee fox cub," she said, looking amused.
She looked him carefully up and down, noting every detail of his appearance with interest.
"Grown to a bonny man, have you no?" she said.
She leaned back in the chair, which creaked loudly under her weight, and squinted appraisingly at him.
"You've the look of the Mackenzies about you, laddie. You always did. But now you're older, you've the look of both your uncles in your face. I'm sure both Dougal and Colum would be pleased you'd remember them so well."
Jamie's eyes were fixed on her as intently as hers on him. He had never liked her, and was unlikely to change his opinion now. But he couldn't afford to antagonise her, not if she had Ian here somewhere. The arrival of the tea interrupted whatever reply she might have made. Jamie moved to my side and sat with me on the sofa, while Gilly carefully poured the tea and handed us each a cup, behaving exactly like a conventional hostess at a tea party. As though wishing to preserve this illusion, she offered the sugar bowl and milk jug, and sat back to make light conversation.
"If you dinna mind my asking, Mrs. Abernathy," Jamie said, "how did you come to this place?"
Politely left unspoken was the larger question.
"How did you escape being burned as a witch?"
She laughed, lowering her long lashes coquettishly over her eyes.
"Well, and you'll maybe recall I was wee child back at Cranesmuir." "I seem to recall something of the sort."
Jamie took a sip of his tea, the tips of his ears turning slightly pink. He had cause to remember that, all right. She had torn off her clothes in the midst of the witch trial, disclosing the secret bulge that would save her life, at least temporarily. A small pink tongue poked out and delicately skimmed the tea droplets from her upper lip.
"Have you had children yourself?" she asked, cocking an eyebrow at me.
"I have. Terrible chore, isn't it? Dragging about like a mud-caked sow and then being ripped apart for the sake of something that looks like a drowned rat."
She shook her head, making a low noise of disgust in her throat.
"The beauty of motherhood, is it?
Still, I shouldn't complain, I suppose. The wee rattling saved my life for me. And wretched as childbirth is, it's better than being burnt at the stake."
"I suppose so," I said. "Though not having tried the latter, I couldn't say for sure."
Gillis choked in her tea, spraying brown droplets over the front of her dress. She mocked at them carelessly, eyeing me with amusement.
"Well, I've not done it either, but I've seen them burn, Poppet. And to think perhaps even lying in a muddy hole watching your belly grow is better than that."
"They kept you in the thieves' hole all the time." The silver spoon was cool in my hand, but my palm grew sweaty at the memory of the thieves' hole in Crane's Muir. I had spent 3 days there with Gillis Duncan, accused as a witch. How long had she stayed there?
3 months, she said, staring meditatively into her tea. 3 mortal months of frozen feet and crawling vermin, stinking scraps of food and the grave smell clinging to my skin day and night.
She looked up then, mouth twisting in bitter amusement.
"But I bore the child in style at the end. When my pains began, they took me from the hole. Little chance I'd run then, I. And the babe was born in my old bedroom, in the fiscal's house."
Her eyes were slightly clouded, and I wondered whether the liquid in her glass was entirely tea.
"I had diamond-paned windows, do you recall? All in shades of purple and green and white. The finest house in the village."
She smiled reminiscently.
"They gave me the bairn to hold, and the green light fell over his face. He looked as though he was drowned indeed. I thought he should be cold to the touch, like a corpse. But he wasn't. He was warm. Warm as his father's balls."
She laughed suddenly, an ugly sound.
"Why are men such fools? You can lead them anywhere by the cock, for a while. Then give them a son, and you have them by the balls again. But it's all you are to them, whether they're coming in or going out. A cunt."
She was leaning back in her chair. At this, she spread her thighs wide and hoisted her glass in ironic toast above her pubic bone, squinting down across the swelling bulge of belly.
"Well, here's to it, I say. Most powerful thing in the world. The niggers know that, at least."
She took a deep, careless swig of her drink.
"They carve wee idols, all belly and cunt and breasts. Same as men do where we come from, you and I."
She squinted at me, teeth bared in amusement.
"Seen the dirty mags men buy under the counters, then, I?"
The bloodshot green eyes swiveled to Jamie.
"And you'll know the pictures and the books the men pass about among themselves in Paris now, won't you, Fox? It's all the same."
She waved a hand and drank again deeply.
"The only difference is the niggers have the decency to worship it." "Very perceptive of them," Jamie said calmly.
He was sitting back in his chair, long legs stretched out in apparent relaxation, but I could see the tension in the fingers of the hand that gripped his own cup.
"And how do you ken the pictures men look at in Paris, mistress? Abernathy, is it now?"
She might be tipsy, but she was by no means fuddled. She looked up sharply at the tone of his voice and gave him a twisted smile.
"Oh, Mistress Abernethy will do well enough. When I lived in Paris, I had another name. Madame Mélisande Robichaud. Like that one. I thought it a bit grand, but your Uncle Dougal gave it me, so I kept it.
Out of sentiment." My free hand curled into a fist, out of sight in the folds of my skirt. I had heard of Madame Mélisande when we lived in Paris. Not a part of society, she had had some fame as a seer of the future. Ladies of the court consulted her in deepest secrecy for advice on their love lives, their investments, and their pregnancies.
"I imagine you could have told the ladies some interesting things," I said dryly.
Her laugh this time was truly amused.
"Oh, I could indeed. Seldom did, though. Folk don't usually pay for the truth, you know. Sometimes, though. Did you ken that Jean-Paul Marat's mother meant to name her bairn Rudolph? I told her I thought Rudolph was ill-omened. I wondered now and then about that. Would he grow up a revolutionary with a name like Rudolph? Or would he take it all out in writing poems instead? Ever think that, Fox? That a name might make a difference?"
Her eyes were fixed on Jamie, green glass.
Often,
he said, and set down his cup.
It was Dougal got ye away from Crane's Muir, then.
She nodded, stifling a small belch.
Aye. He came to take the babe, alone, for fear someone would find out he was the father, aye. I wouldn't have let it go, though. And when he came near to wrest it from me, why, I snatched the duck from his belt and pressed it to the child's throat.
A small smile of satisfaction at the memory curved her lovely lips.
Told him I'd kill it, sure, unless he swore on his brother's life and his own soul to get me safe away.
And he believed you? I felt mildly ill at the thought of any mother holding a knife to the throat of her newborn child, even in pretense. Her gaze swiveled back to me.
Oh, yes,
she said softly, and the smile widened.
He knew me, did Dougal.
Sweating, even in the chill of December, and unable to take his eyes off the tiny face of his sleeping son, Dougal had agreed.
When he leaned over me to take the child, I thought of plunging the dirk into his own throat instead,
she said reminiscently.
But it would have been a good deal harder to get away by myself. So I didn't.
Jamie's expression didn't change, but he picked up his tea and took a deep swallow. Dougal had summoned the locksman, John McCrae, and the church sexton, and by means of discreet bribery ensured that the hooded figure dragged on a hurdle to the pitch barrel next morning would not be that of Gillis Duncan.
I thought they'd use straw, maybe, she said, but he was a cleverer man than that. Old Granny Joan Mackenzie had died 3 days before and was meant to be burying that same afternoon. A few rocks in the coffin and the lid nailed down tight and Bob's your uncle, eh? A real body, fine for burning.
She laughed and gulped the last swallow of her drink.
Not everyone's seen their own funeral. Fewer still have seen their own execution, aye?
It had been the dead of winter, and the small grove of rowan trees outside the village stood bare, drifted with their own dead leaves, the dried red berries showing here and there on the ground like spots of blood. It was a cloudy day, with a promise of sleet or snow, but the whole village turned out nonetheless. A witch burning was not an event to be missed. The village priest, Father Bain, had died himself 3 months before of fever brought on by a festering sore, but a new priest had been imported for the occasion from a village nearby. Perfuming his way with a censer held before him, the priest had come down the path to the grove, chanting the service for the dead. Behind him came the locksman and his two assistants, dragging the hurdle and its black-robed burden.
I expect Granny Joan would have been pleased, Gilly said, white teeth gleaming at the vision. She couldn't have expected more nor 4 nor 5 people to her burying. As it was, she had the whole village and the incense and special prayers to boot.
McCrae had untied the body and carried it, lolling, to the barrel of pitch, ready waiting.
The court granted me the mercy to be with it before the burning, Gillis explained ironically. So they expected the body to be dead. No difficulty there. If I was strangled already. The only thing anyone might have seen was that Granny Joan weighed half what I did, newly delivered as I was, but no one seemed to notice she was light in McCrae's arms.
You were there? I said.
She nodded smugly.
Oh, aye. Well muffled in a cloak. Everyone was, because of the weather. But I wouldn't have missed it.
As the priest finished his last prayer against the evils of enchantment, McCrae had taken the pine torch from his assistant and stepped forward.
God omit not this woman from thy covenant and the many evils that she in the body committed, he had said, and flung the fire into the pitch.
It was faster than I thought it would be, Gillis said,
sounding mildly surprised.
A great whoosh of fire. There was a blast of hot air and a cheer from the crowd, and not to be seen but the flame shooting up high enough to singe the rowan branches overhead.
The fire had subsided within a minute, though, and the dark figure within was clear enough to be seen through the pale daylight flames. The hood and the hair had burned away with the first scorching rush, and the face itself was burned beyond recognition. A few moments more, and the clean, dark shapes of the bones emerged from the melted flesh, an airy superstructure rising above the charring barrel.
"Only great empty holes where her eyes had been," she said.
The moss-green eyes turned toward me, clouded by memory.
I thought perhaps she was looking at me, but then the skull exploded and it was all over, and folk began to come away, all except a few who stayed in hopes of picking up a bit of bone as a keepsake.
She rose and went unsteadily to the small table near the window. She picked up the silver bell and rang it hard.
"Aye," she said, her back turned to us. "Childbirth is maybe easier." "So Dougal got you away to France," Jamie said.
The fingers of his right hand twitched slightly.
"How came you here to the West Indies?"
"Oh, that was later," she said carelessly, "after Culloden." She turned then and smiled from Jamie to me.
"And what might bring the two of you here to this place? Surely not the pleasure of my company."
I glanced at Jamie, seeing the slight tensing of his back as he sat up straighter. His face stayed calm, though, only his eyes bright with wariness.
"We've come to seek a young kinsman of mine," he said, "my nephew Ian Murray. We've some reason to think he's indentured here."
Gailey's pale brows rose high, making soft ridges in her forehead. "Ian Murray," she said, and shook her head in puzzlement.
"I've no indentured whites at all here. No whites, come to that. The only free man on the place is the overseer, and he's what they call a griffon, one quarter black."
This ends Disc 32. Voyager, Disc 33.
Unlike me, Gillis Duncan was a very good liar. Impossible to tell, from her expression of mild interest, whether she had ever heard the name Ian Murray before. But lying she was, and I knew it. Jamie knew it too. The expression that flashed through his eyes wasn't disappointment, but fury, quickly suppressed.
"Indeed," he said politely. "And are you not fearful, then, alone with your slaves here, so far from town?"
"Oh, no, not at all." She smiled broadly at him, then lifted her double chin and waggled it gently in the direction of the terrace behind him. I turned my head and saw that the French door was filled from jamb to doorpost with an immense black man, several inches taller than Jamie, from whose rolled-up shirt sleeves protruded arms like tree trunks knotted with muscle.
"Meet Hercules," Gailey said with a tiny laugh.
"He has a twin brother, too."
"Named Atlas, by chance?" I asked with an edge to my voice. "You guessed. Is she no the clever one, eh, Fox?"
She winked conspiratorially at Jamie, the rounded flesh of her cheek wobbling with the movement. The light caught her from the side as she turned her head, and I saw the red spider webs of tiny broken capillaries that netted her jowls. Hercules took no note of this, or of anything else. His broad face was slack and dull, and there was no life in the deep-sunk eyes beneath the bony brow ridge. It gave me a very uneasy feeling to look at him, and not only because of his threatening size. Looking at him was like passing by a haunted house where something lurks behind blind windows.
"That will do, Hercule. You can go back to work now."
Gilly picked up the silver bell and tinkled it gently once. Without a word, the giant turned and lumbered off the veranda.
"I have no fear of the slaves," she explained. "They're afraid of me, for they think I'm a witch. Very funny, considering, is it not?"
Her eyes twinkled behind little pouches of fat. "Gilly, that man," I hesitated, feeling ridiculous in asking such a question. "He's not a zombie." She laughed delightedly at that, clapping her hands together.
"Christ, a zombie! Jesus, Claire!"
She chortled with glee, a bright pink rising from throat to hair roots.
"Well, I'll tell you, he's no very bright," she said at last, still gasping and wheezing. "But he's no dead either.
and went off into further gales of laughter. Jamie stared at me, puzzled.
"Zombie?"
"Never mind," I said, my face nearly as pink as Gilly's. "How many slaves have you got here?" I asked, wanting to change the subject. She said, winding down into giggles.
"Oh, 100 or so. It's no such a big place. Only 300 acres in cane and a wee bit of coffee on the upper slopes."
She pulled a lace-trimmed handkerchief from her pocket and patted her damp face, sniffing a bit as she regained her composure. I could feel, rather than see, Jamie's tension. I was sure he was as convinced as I that Gilly knew something about Ian Murray. If nothing else, she had betrayed no surprise whatever at our appearance. Someone had told about us, and that someone could only be Ian. The thought of threatening a woman to extract information wasn't one that would come naturally to Jamie, but it would to me. Unfortunately, the presence of the twin pillars of Hercules had put a stop to that line of thought. The next best idea seemed to be to search the house and grounds for any trace of the boy. 300 acres was a fair piece of ground, but if he was on the property, he would likely be in or near the buildings, the house, the sugar refinery, or the slave quarters. I came out of my thoughts to realise that Gilly had asked me a question.
"What's that?"
"I said," she repeated patiently, "that you had a great deal of talent for the healing when I knew you in Scotland. You'll maybe know more now."
"I expect I might." I looked her over cautiously. Did she want my skill for herself?
She wasn't healthy. A glance at her mottled complexion and the dark circles beneath her eyes was enough to show that. But was she actively ill?
"Not for me," she said, seeing my look. "Not just now, anyway. I've two slaves gone sick. Maybe you'd be so kind as to look at them."
I glanced at Jamie, who gave me the shadow of a nod. It was a chance to get into the slave quarters and look for Ian.
"I saw when we came in as you had a bit of trouble with your sugar press," he said, rising abruptly.
He gave Gilly a cool nod.
"Perhaps I shall have a look at it while Stew and my wife tend the sick."
Without waiting for an answer, he took off his coat and hung it on the peg by the door. He went out by the veranda, rolling up the sleeves of his shirt, sunlight glinting on his hair.
"A handy sort, is he?"
Gilly looked after him, amused.
"My husband Barnabas was that sort. Couldn't keep his hands off any kind of machine.
Or off the slave girls, either," she added.
"Come along. The sick ones are back at the kitchen."
The kitchen was in a separate small building of its own, connected to the house by a breezeway covered with blooming jasmine. Walking through it was like floating through a cloud of perfume surrounded by a hum of bees loud enough to be felt on the skin, like the low drone of a bagpipe.
"Ever been stung?"
Gilles swiped casually at a low-flying furry body, batting it out of the air.
"Now and then." "So have I," she said. "Any number of times, and nothing worse than a red welt on my skin to show for it. One of these wee buggers stung one of the kitchen slaves last spring, though, and the wench swelled up like a toad and died right before my eyes."
She glanced at me, eyes wide and mocking.
"Did wonders for my reputation, I can tell you. The rest of the slaves put it about I'd witched the lass. Put a spell on her to kill her for burning the sponge cake. I haven't had so much as a scorched pot since."
Shaking her head, she waved away another bee. While appalled at her callousness, I was somewhat relieved by the story. Perhaps the other gossip I had heard at the governor's ball had as little foundation in fact. I paused, looking out through the jasmine's lacy leaves at the cane fields below. Jamie was in the clearing by the sugar press, looking up at the gigantic crossbars of the machine, while a man I assumed to be the overseer pointed and explained. As I watched, he said something, gesturing, and the overseer nodded emphatically, waving his hands in voluble reply. If I didn't find any trace of Ian in the kitchen quarters, perhaps Jamie would learn something from the overseer. Despite Geely's denials, every instinct I had insisted that the boy was here. Somewhere.
There was no sign of him in the kitchen itself. Only three or four women kneading bread and snapping peas, who looked up curiously.